paid the least attention to the baby, or to Christina herself. "Where is the corrupted man?" the prince said. Christina whispered to me, "He's in the barn. We put him in a..." I thought to have the room back. We didn't want... I didn't mean any harm. She didn't need to explain why she hadn't wanted that tormented face in her house every night. "It's all right," I said. "Christina, yoursie might... What we can try, it might not... It will work. But he might die of it." Her hands were gripping the side of the cradle, but she only nodded a little. I think he was already gone in her mind by then, as though he'd been at a battle that had been lost, and she only waited to hear the final word. We went outside. 7 small rooting pigs and their big-bellied mother looked up snuffling incuriously at our horses from a new-built pen by the side of the house, the wood of the fence still pale brown and unweathered. We rode around it and single file down a narrow path through the trees, already almost overgrown, to the small gray barn. It stood in a tall grass, full of eager saplings springing up, a few ragged holes in the thatch, where birds had picked it apart for nests, and the bar across the door rusted in its hooks. It already had the feeling of a long-abandoned place. "Open it up, Michal," the captain of the guard said, and one of the soldiers slid down and went tramping ahead through the grass. He was a young man, and like most of the soldiers, he wore his brown hair long and straight, with a long dangling mustache and beard, braided, all of them like pictures in the Dragon's History books of the old days, the founding of Polnia. He was as strong as a young oak, tall and broad, even among the other soldiers. He slid the bar over with one hand and pushed open both of the doors with an easy shove, letting the afternoon sunlight into the barn. Then he jerked back with a wordless, choked noise in his throat, hand moving towards his sword belt, and almost stumbled over his own feet, backing away. Yorzi was propped against the back wall, and the light had shone full onto the snarl of his twisted face. The statue's eyes were looking straight out at us. "What a hideous grimace," Prince Marek said in an offhand tone. "All right, Janos," he added to the chief of his guard, sliding off his horse. "Take the men and the horses to the village green and get them under some sort of cover. The beasts won't sit still for a lot of magic and howling, I imagine." "Yes, Your Highness," Janos said, and jerked his head to his second. The soldiers were as happy as the horses to be out of it. They took our mounts too, and went eagerly, a few of them glancing sidelong through the barn doors. I saw Michal look back over his hunched shoulder several times, the ruddy color gone out of his face. None of them understood really about the wood. They weren't men from the valley. As I've said, the dragon didn't need to levy a troop to send to the king's army, and they weren't from anywhere nearby either. They carried shields marked with the crest of a knight upon a horse, so they were all from the northern provinces, around Tarakai, where Queen Hannah had come from. Their idea of magic was a lightning strike on a battlefield, deadly and clean. They didn't know what they were riding to face. "Wait," the dragon said, before Janos turned his own horse to follow the rest of them. "While you're there, buy 2 sacks of salt and divide it into pouches, 1 for each man. Then find scarves to cover all their mouths and noses, and buy every axe that anyone will spare you." He looked at the prince. "There won't be any time to waste. If this even works, the best we'll have won is the briefest opportunity. A day, 2 at most, while the wood recovers from the blow." Prince Marek nodded to Janos, confirming the orders. "See to it everyone gets a little rest, if they can," he said. "We'll ride straight for the wood as soon as we're done here." And pray that the queen isn't deep inside it, the dragon added flatly. Janos darted a glance at him and back to the prince. But Marek only slapped the flank of Janos's horse and turned away, a dismissal. Janos followed the other men away, down the narrow path and out of sight. We were left alone just inside the barn, the five of us. Dust floated through the sunlight, the warm, sweet smell of hay, but with a faint, choking undercurrent of rotting leaves beneath. I could see a broken, jagged-edged hole gaping in the side of the wall where the wolves had come through, not to eat the cattle, but to savage and corrupt them. I hugged myself. The day was growing late. We'd ridden straight across the valley to Dvernik, since before the morning light, only stopping long enough to let the horses rest. Wind stirred through the doors and blew against my neck, a cold touch. The sun was orange on Yorzi's face, his wide, unseeing stone eyes. I remembered the cold, still feeling of being stone. I wondered if Yorzi could see out of his own fixed gaze, or if the wood had closed him into darkness. The dragon looked at the falcon and made a wide mocking sweep of his arm towards Yorzi. Perhaps you'd care to be of some assistance? The falcon gave him a thin, smiling bow and went to stand before the statue with upraised hands. The words to lift the stone spell came ringing off his tongue, beautifully enunciated, and as he spoke, Yorzi's fingertips curled in with a twitch as the stone drained out of them. The stiffened claws of his hands were still outstretched to either side of him, and the rusting chains hanging from his wrists had been nailed to the wall. The metal links scraped against one another as he started to move. The falcon backed away a little, still smiling, as the stone retreated slowly down from the crown of Yorzi's head and his eyes began to roll and dart from side to side. A shrill, faint thread of laughter whizzed out of him as his mouth came loose. Then the stone freed his lungs, and the smile slid off the falcon's face as it rose and rose to a shrieking pitch. Kasha moved against me, clumsily, and I gripped her hand. She stood beside me, like a statue herself, rigid and remembering. Yorzi howled and laughed and howled over and over, as though he was trying to make up for all the howls that had been closed up inside his stone chest. He howled until he was out of breath, and then he lifted his head and grinned at us all with his blackened and rotting teeth, his skin still mottled green. Prince Marek was staring at him, his hand clenched on his sword. The falcon had backed away to his side.
"Hallo, princeling,"
Yorzi crooned to him.
"Do you miss your mother? Would you like to hear her scream too, Marek?"
Yorzi shrilled suddenly in a woman's voice, high and desperate.
"Marek! Save me!"
Marek flinched bodily, as if something had struck him in the gut, 3 inches of his sword blade coming out of its sheath, before he stopped.
"Stop it," he snarled. "Make it be silent."
The falcon raised a hand and said,
"Elreka dut,"
still staring and appalled. Yorzi's wide-mouthed cackles went muffled, as if he'd been closed up inside a thick-walled room. Only a faint, distant whine of
"Marecek! Marecek!"
still coming through. The falcon whirled towards us.
"You can't possibly mean to cleanse this thing." "Ah, so now you're feeling squeamish," the dragon said, cold and cutting.
"Look at him,"
the falcon said.
He turned back and said, "Leleyast palesh,"
and swept his open hand down through the air, as though he were wiping down a pane of glass covered in steam. I recoiled, Kasha's hand clenching painfully on mine.
We stared in horror. Yours's skin had gone translucent, a thin, greenish onion skin layer. And beneath it, nothing but black squirming masses of corruption that boiled and seethed. Like the shadows I'd seen beneath my own skin, but grown so fat that devoured everything there was inside him, even coiling beneath his face, his stained yellow eyes barely peering out of the grotesque, seething clouds.
And yet you were prepared to ride blithely into the wood, the dragon said. He turned. Prince Marek was staring at Yorzi, gray as a mirror. His mouth was a narrow, bloodless line. The dragon said to him, "Listen to me. This," he gestured at Yorzi, "this is nothing. His corruption is thrice removed, less than 3 days old, thanks to the stone spell. If it were only 4 times removed instead, I could have cleansed him with the usual purgative. The queen's been held in a heart tree for 20 years. If we can find her, if we can bring her out, if we can purge her, none of which is remotely certain, she'll still have lived 20 years in the worst torment the wood can devise. She won't embrace you. She won't even know you. We have a true chance against the wood here," he added. "If we succeed in purging this man, if we destroy another heart tree doing it, we shouldn't use that opening to make a foolish, headlong charge deep into the bowels of the wood, risking everything. We should begin at the nearest border, cut a road into the wood as deep as we can, from sunrise to sunset, and then set Fireheart in the forest behind us before we retreat. We could reclaim 20 miles of this valley and weaken the wood for 3 generations. And if my mother burns with it," Prince Marek said, wheeling on him. The dragon nodded towards Yorzi. "Would you rather live like that?"
"Then if she doesn't burn?" Marek said, "No."
He heaved a breath like there were iron bands around his chest.
"No."
The dragon's mouth compressed.
"If we were able to so weaken the wood, our chances of finding her..."
"No," Marek said, a slash of his hand cutting him off. "We'll bring my mother out, and as we go, we'll lay waste as much of the wood as we can. Then, dragon, when you've purged her and burned the heart tree that held her, I swear you'll have every man an axe that my father can spare you. And we won't just burn the wood back 20 miles. We'll burn it all the way to Rosia and be rid of it for good." He straightened as he spoke, his shoulders going back. He'd planted himself still more firmly. I bit my own lip. I trusted Prince Marek not at all, except to please himself. But I couldn't help feeling that he had the right of it. If we cut the wood back, even 20 miles, it would be a great victory, but only a temporary one. I wanted all of it to burn. I'd always hated the wood, of course, but distantly. It had been a hailstorm before harvest, a swarm of locusts in the field, more horrible than those things, more like a nightmare, but still just acting according to its nature. Now it was something else entirely. A living thing deliberately reaching out the full force of its malice to hurt me, to hurt everyone I loved, looming over my entire village and ready to swallow it up, just like Parosnya. I wasn't dreaming of myself as a great heroine, as the dragon had accused me, but I did want to ride into the wood with axe and fire. I wanted to rip the queen out of its grasp, call up armies on either side, and raise it to the ground. The dragon shook his head after a moment, but silently. He didn't argue any further. Instead, it was the falcon who made a protest now. He didn't look nearly as certain as Prince Marek. His eyes still lingered on Yorzi, and he had a corner of his white cloak pressed over his mouth and nose,
as though he saw more than we did, and feared to breathe in some sickness.
I hope you'll forgive my doubts. Perhaps I am merely woefully inexperienced in these matters, he said, the tense, sarcastic edge of his voice coming clearly even through the cloak. But I would have called this a truly remarkable case of corruption. He's not even safe to behead before burning. Perhaps we'd best make sure you can free him before you choose among grandiose plans, none of which can even be begun.
We agreed, Prince Marek said, wheeling around to him in urgent protest.
I agreed it was a risk worth taking if Sarkhan had really found some way to purge corruption, the Falcon said to him. But this... He looked again at Yerzi. Not until I've seen him do it. And I'll look twice even then. For all we know, the girl was never corrupted in the first place. And he put the rumor about himself to add still more luster to his reputation.
The dragon snorted disdainfully and didn't offer him any other answer. He turned and pulled a handful of haystacks from one of the old falling apart bales and began to murmur a charm over them as his fingers quickly bent them together. Prince Marek seized the falcon's arm and dragged him aside, whispering angrily. Yerzi was still singing to himself behind the muffling spell, but he had begun to swing himself in the chains, running forward until his arms were stretched as far as they could go behind him, held taut by the chains and straining, flinging himself against them and lunging his head forward to snap a bite at the air. He let his tongue hang out, a grossly swollen, blackened thing, as though a slug had crawled into his mouth, and waggled it and rolled his eyes at us all. The dragon ignored him. In his hands, the haystacks thickened and grew into a small, knobby-ledged table, barely a foot wide, and then he took the leather satchel he'd brought with him and opened it up. He drew the summoning out carefully. The sun set, making the golden embossed letters blaze, and he laid it upon the small table. All right, he said, turning to me. Let's begin. I hadn't really thought about it until then, with the prince and the falcon turning towards us, that I would have to take the dragon's hand in front of all of them, join my magic to his while they watched. My stomach shriveled like a dried plum. I darted a look at the dragon, but his face was deliberately aloof, as though he was only mildly interested by anything we were doing. I reluctantly went to stand beside him. The falcon's eyes were on me, and I was sure there was magic in his gaze, predatory and piercing. I hated the thought of being exposed before him, before Marek. I hated it almost worse to have Kasha there, who knew me so well. I hadn't told her much about that night, about the last time the dragon and I had tried a working together. I hadn't been able to put it into words. I hadn't wanted to think about it that much. But I couldn't refuse, not with Yerzi dancing on his chains like the toy my father had whittled me long ago, the funny little stickman who jumped and somersaulted between two poles. I swallowed and put my hand on the cover of the summoning. I opened it, and together the dragon and I began to read. We were stiff and awkward beside each other, but our workings joined as though they knew the way by now without us. My shoulders eased, my head lifted. I drew a deep, glad breath into my lungs. I couldn't help it. I couldn't care if all the world was watching. The summoning flowed around us easily as a river. His voice, a rippling chant, that I filled with waterfalls and leaping fish, and the light dawned bright and brilliant as an early sunrise around us. And in Yerzi's face, the wood looked out and snarled at us with soundless hatred.
Is it working?
Prince Marek asked the falcon behind us. I didn't hear his answer. Yerzi was lost in the wood, just as Kasha had been. But he had given up. He was sitting slumped against the trunk of a tree. his bleeding feet stretched out in front of him, the muscles of his jaw slack, staring blankly down at his hands in his lap. He didn't move when I called him.
"Yorzy!"
I cried. "Dolly," he lifted his head. Dolly looked at me, and then put it down again.
"I see. There is a channel," the falcon said, when I glanced at him.
I saw he'd put his blindfold mask on again. That strange hawk's eye was peering out of his forehead, its black pupil wide.
"That's the way the corruption travels out from the wood. Sarkhan, if I cast a purging fire down along it now..."
"No," I said in quick protest. "Yorzy will die." The falcon threw me a dismissive look. He didn't care anything if Yorzy lived or died, of course. But Kasha turned and dashed out of the barn, down the pathway, and a little while later, she brought a wary Christina back to us, the baby cuddled in her arms. Christina shrunk back from the magic, from Yorzy's writhing, but Kasha whispered to her urgently. Christina clutched the baby tighter and slowly took one step closer, then another, until she could look into Yorzy's face. Her own changed.
"Yorzy," she called, "Yorzy,"
and stretched her hand towards him. Kasha held her back from touching his face, but deep within, I saw him lift his head again and then slowly push up onto his feet. The light of the summoning was no more forgiving to him. I felt it at a distance this time. Not something that touched me directly, but he was bared to us, full of anger. The small graves of all the children and Christina's mutely suffering face, the pinch of hunger in his belly and his sour resentment of the small baskets of charity he pretended not to see in the corners of his house, knowing she'd gone begging. The simple, raw desperation of seeing the cows turned, his last grasping clutch at a way out of poverty torn away. He'd half wanted the beasts to kill him. Christina's face was vivid with her own sluggish desperation, helpless, dark thoughts. Her mother had told her not to marry a poor man. Her sister in Radomsko had 4 children and a husband who wove cloth for a living. Her sister's children had lived. Her sister's children had never been cold and starving. Yorzy's mouth pulled wide with shame, trembling, teeth clenched. But Christina sobbed once and reached for him again. And then the baby woke and yelled, an awful noise, but somehow wonderful by comparison. So ordinary and uncomplicated. Nothing but a raw demand. Yorzy took one step. And then it was suddenly much easier. The dragon was right. This corruption was weaker than Kasha's had been, for all it had looked so dreadful. Yorzy wasn't deep in the wood as she had been. Once he began moving, he came stumbling towards us quickly, and though branches threw themselves in his way, they were only thin slapping things. He put his arms in front of his face and began to run towards us, pushing through them.
"Take the spell," the dragon said to me as we came to the very end, and I set my teeth and held the summoning with all my might while he drew his magic free from mine. "Now," he said to the falcon, "as he emerges." And as Yorzy began to crowd forward into his own face, they raised their hands side by side and spoke at the same time. "Ulogistu sovienta!" Yorzy screamed as he pushed forward through the purging fire. But he did come through. A few tarry, stinking drops squeezed out of the corners of his eyes and ran out of his nostrils and fell to the ground, smoking, and his body fell limply, sagging in his chains. Kasha kicked some dirt over the drops, and the dragon stepped forward to grip Yorzy's face by the chin, holding him up as I finished reading the summoning at last. "Look now," he said to the falcon. The falcon put his hands to either side of Yorzy's face and spoke, a spell like an arrow. It snapped away from him in the final terrible blaze of light from the summoning. On the wall between the chains, above Yorzi's head, the falcon's spell opened a window, and we all saw for one moment a tall, old heart tree, twice the size of the one Kasha had been inside. Its limbs were thrashing wildly in a crackling blaze of fire.
Chapter 14. The soldiers were laughing to one another gaily as we left Dvernik in the hush before dawn the next morning. They had armed themselves and were all very splendid looking, and their bright mail, their nodding plumed helms and long green cloaks, their painted shields hung on their saddles. They knew it too. They marched their horses proudly through the dark lanes, and even the horses held their necks arched. Of course, 30 scarves weren't easily come by out of a small village, so most of the men were wearing thick itchy woolen ones meant for winter, wrapped haphazardly around their necks and faces as the dragon had ordered. They kept breaking their careful poise and involuntarily reaching beneath to scratch every so often surreptitiously. I'd grown up riding my father's big slow draft horses, who would only look around at me in mild surprise if I stood upside down on their broad backs and refused to have anything to do with trotting, much less a canter. But Prince Marek had put us on spare horses his knights had brought with them, and they seemed like entirely different animals. When I accidentally tugged on the reins in some wrong way, my horse jumped up onto its hind legs and lashed out its hooves, crow-stepping forward while I clung in alarm to its mane. It came down after some time, for reasons equally impenetrable to me, and pranced along very satisfied with itself. At least until we passed Zatochek. There wasn't a single place where the valley road ended. I suppose it had gone on much farther once, on to Porosna, and maybe to some other nameless long-swallowed village beyond it. But before the creak of the mill house at Zatochek bridge faded behind us, the weeds and grass began to nibble at the edges, and a mile onward we could barely tell that it was still underfoot. The soldiers were still laughing and singing, but the horses were wiser than we were, maybe. Their pace slowed without any signal from their riders. They whiffed nervously and jerked their heads, their ears pricked forward and back, and their skin giving nervous shivers, as if flies were bothering them. But there were no flies. Up ahead, the wall of dark trees was waiting. "Pull up here," the dragon said, and as if they'd understood him and were glad of the excuse, the horses halted almost at once, all of them. "Get a drink of water and eat something, if you like. Let nothing more pass your lips once we are beneath the trees." He swung down from his horse. I climbed down from my own, very cautiously. "I'll take her," one of the soldiers said to me, a blond boy with a friendly round face marred only by a twice broken nose. He clucked to my mare, cheerful and competent. All the men were taking their horses to drink from the river and passing around loaves of bread and flasks with liquor in them. The dragon beckoned me over. "Put on your protection spell, as thickly as you can," he said, "and then try to place it on the soldiers if you can. I'll lay another on you as well." "Will it keep the shadows out of us?" I said doubtfully. "Even inside the wood?" "No, but it will slow them down," he said. "There is a barn just outside Zatochek. I keep it stocked with purgatives against the need to go into the wood. As soon as we are out again, we'll go there and dose ourselves 10 times, no matter how certain you are that you're clear." I looked at the crowd of young soldiers, talking and laughing among themselves as they ate their bread. "Do you have enough for all of them?" He turned a cold, certain look over them, like a sweep of a scythe. "For however many of them will be left," he said. I shivered. "You still don't think this is a good idea, even after Yerzi?" A thin plume of smoke still rose from the wood, where the heart tree burned. We'd seen it yesterday. It's a dreadful idea, the dragon said. But letting Marek lead you and Soli in there without me is a still worse one. At least I have some idea what to expect. Come, we don't have much time. Kasha silently helped me gather bundles of pine needles for my spell. The falcon was already building an elaborate shield of his own around Prince Marek, like a shining wall of bricks going up one after another. And when he had raised it above Marek's head, the whole thing glowed as a whole and then collapsed in on him. If I glanced at Marek sideways, I could see the faint shimmer of it clinging to his skin. The falcon put another one on himself. I noticed he didn't lay it on any of the soldiers, though. I knelt and made a smudge fire of my pine needles and branches. When the smoke was filling the clearing, bitter and throat-drying, I looked up at the dragon. "Cast yours now?" I asked. The dragon's spell, settling on my shoulders, felt like putting on a heavy coat in front of the fireplace. It left me itchy and uncomfortable, and thinking too much about why I was going to need it. I hummed my protection spell along with his chant, imagining that I was bundling up the rest of the way against the heart of winter. Not just coat, but mittens, woolen scarf, hat with the ear covers buttoned down, knitted pants over my boots, and veils wrapped over it all. Everything tucked snugly in, leaving no cracks for the cold air to wriggle through. "All of you, pull up your scarves," I said without looking away from my smoky fire, forgetting a moment that I was talking to grown men, soldiers, and what was other still was they did what I said. I pushed the smoke out around me, letting it sink into the wool and cotton of their wraps, carrying protection with it. The last of the needles crumbled into ash. The fire went out. I climbed a little unsteadily up to my feet, coughing from the smoke, and rubbed my tearing eyes. When I blinked them clear again, I flinched. The falcon was watching me, hungry and intent, even as he drew a fold of his own cloak up over his mouth and nose. I turned quickly away and went to get a drink from the river myself and wash the smoke from my hands and face. I didn't like the way his eyes tried to pierce my skin. Kasha and I shared a loaf of bread ourselves, the endlessly familiar daily loaf from Dvernik's baker, crusty and gray-brown and a little bit sour, the taste of every morning at home. The soldiers were putting away their flasks and wiping off crumbs and getting back on their horses. The sun had broken over the trees. "All right, Falcon," Prince Marek said, when we were all back on our horses. He drew off his gauntlet. He had a ring sitting above the first joint of his smallest finger, a delicate round band of gold set with small blue jewels, a woman's ring.
"Show us the way."
"Hold your thumb above the band," the falcon said, and leaning over from his own horse, he pricked Marek's finger with a jeweled pin and squeezed it. A fat drop of blood fell onto the ring, painting the gold red, while the falcon murmured a finding spell. The blue stones turned dark purple. A violet light gathered around Marek's hand, and even when he pulled his gauntlet back on, the light still limned it. He raised his fist up before him and moved it from side to side. It brightened when he held it towards the wood. He led us forward, and one after another, our horses crossed over the ash and went into the dark trees. The wood was a different place in spring than in winter. There was a sense of quickening and wakefulness. My skin shivered with the sense of watching eyes all around as soon as the first bough shadows touched me. The horses' hooves fell with muffled blows on the ground, picking over moss and underbrush, edging past brambles that reached for us with long pricking thorns. Silent dark birds darted almost invisible from tree to tree, pacing us. I was sure suddenly that if I had come alone in spring, I wouldn't have reached Kasha at all, not without a fight. But today, we rode with 30 men around us, all of them armored and armed. The soldiers carried long heavy blades and torches and sacks of salt, as the dragon had ordered. The ones riding in the lead hacked at the brush, widening the trails as we pushed our way along them. The rest burned back the brambles to either side and salted the earth of the path behind us so we'd be able to retreat the way we'd come. But their laughter died. We rode silently, but for the muffled jingle of harness, the soft thuds of hooves on the bare track, a murmur of a word to one another here and there. The horses didn't even whicker anymore. They watched the trees with large eyes rimmed with white. We all felt that we were hunted. Kasha rode next to me, and her head was bowed deeply over her horse's neck. I managed to reach out and catch her fingers with mine. "What is it?" I said softly. She looked away from our path and pointed towards a tree in the distance, an old blackened oak struck years before by lightning. Moss hung from its dead branches like a bent old woman spreading wide her skirts to curtsy. "I remember that tree," she said. She dropped her hand and stared straight ahead through her horse's ears. "And that red rock we passed. And the gray bramble. All of them. It's as though I didn't leave." She was whispering, too. "It's as though I never left at all. I don't know if you're even real, Neshka. What if I've only been having another dream?" I squeezed her hand, helplessly. I didn't know how to comfort her. "There is something nearby," she said. "Something up ahead." The captain heard her and glanced back.
"Something dangerous?"
"Something dead," Kasha said and dropped her eyes to her saddle, her hands clenched on the reins. The light was brightening around us, and the track widened beneath the horses' feet. Their shoes clopped hollowly. I looked down and saw cobblestones half burned beneath moss, broken. When I looked back up, I flinched. In the distance, through the trees, a ghostly gray face stared back at me, with a huge hollow eye above a wide square mouth, a gutted barn.
"Get off the track," the dragon said sharply. "Go around, north or south, it doesn't matter. But don't ride through the square, and keep moving." "What is this place?" Marek said.
"Parosna," the dragon said.
"Or what's left of it."
We turned our horses and went north, picking our way through brambles and the ruins of small poor houses, sagging on their beams, thatched roofs fallen in. I tried not to look at the ground. Moss and fine grass covered it thickly, and tall, young trees were stretching up for sun, already spreading out overhead and breaking the sunlight into moving, shifting dapples. But there were shapes still half buried beneath the moss. Here and there, a hand of bones breaking the sod, white fingertips poking through the soft carpeting green that caught the light and gleamed cold. Above the houses, if I looked towards where the village square would have stood, a vast shining silver canopy spread, and I could hear the far-off rustling whisper of the leaves of a heart tree.
"Couldn't we stop and burn it?" I whispered to the dragon as softly as I could.
"Certainly," he said. "If we used Fireheart and retreated the way we came at once, it would be the wise thing to do."
He didn't keep his voice down, but Prince Marek didn't look around, though a few of the soldiers glanced at us. The horses stretched their necks, trembling, and we rode on quickly, leaving the dead behind us. We stopped a little while later to give the horses a rest. They were all tired from fear as much as effort. The path had widened around some marshy ground, the end of a spring creek that was drying up now as the snow melt stopped running. A small trickle still came bubbling along and made a wide, clear pool over a bed of rocks.
"Is it safe to let the horses drink?" Prince Marek asked the dragon, who shrugged. "You may as well," he said. It's not much worse than having them beneath the trees. You'd have to put them all down after this in any case.
Janos had already slid down from his horse. He had a hand on its nose, calming the animal. He jerked his head around.
These are trained war horses. They're worth their weight in silver. And purging elixir is worth their weight in gold, the dragon said. If you felt tender towards them, you shouldn't have brought them into the wood. But don't distress yourself overly. Chances are, the question won't arise.
Prince Marek threw him a hard look, but he didn't quarrel. Instead, he caught Janos aside and spoke to him consolingly. Kasha had gone to stand by the edge of the clearing, where a handful of deer tracks continued on. She was looking away from the pool. I wondered if she'd seen this place too, in her long, wandering imprisonment. She stared into the dark trees. The dragon came past her. He glanced at her and spoke. I saw her head turn toward him.
I wonder if you know what he owes you, the falcon said unexpectedly behind me.
I startled and turned my head around. My horse was drinking thirstily. I gripped the reins and edged a little closer to its warm side. I didn't say anything. The falcon only raised one narrow eyebrow, black and neat.
The kingdom hasn't a limitless store of wizards. By law, the gift places you beyond vassalage. You have a right to a place at court now, and the patronage of the king himself. You should never have been kept here in this valley in the first place, much less treated like a drudge.
He waved a hand up and down at my clothes. I had dressed myself as I would have to go gleaning, in tall mud boots, loose work trousers sewn of sacking, and a brown smock over it all. He still wore his white cloak, although the wood's malice was stronger than whatever charm he'd used to keep it neat in the ordinary woods. There were threads snagged along the edge of it. He misunderstood my doubtful look.
Your father is a farmer, I suppose?
A woodcutter, I said.
He flicked a hand, as if to say it made not the least difference.
Then you know nothing of the court, I imagine. When the gift rose in me, the king raised my father to a knighthood, and when I finished my training, to a barony. He will not be less generous to you.
He leaned towards me, and my horse snorted bubbles in the water as I leaned hard against her.
Whatever you may have heard growing up in this backwater, Sarkhan is by no means the only wizard of note in Polnia. I assure you that you needn't feel bound to him simply because he's found an interesting way to use you. I'm certain there are many other wizards you could align yourself with.
He extended his hand towards me and raised a thin spiraling flame in the palm of his hand with the murmured words.
Perhaps you'd care to try? With you? I blurted undiplomatically.
His eyes narrowed a little at the corners. I didn't feel at all sorry, though.
After what you did to Kasha?
He put on injured surprise, like a second cloak.
I've done her and you a favor. Do you imagine anyone would have been willing to take Sarkhan's word for her cure? Your patron might charitably be called eccentric, burying himself out here and coming to court only when he's summoned, gloomy as a storm, and issuing warnings of inevitable disasters that somehow never come. He hasn't any friends at court, and the few who would stand beside him are the very doomsayers who insisted on having your friend put to death at once. If Prince Marek hadn't intervened, the king would have sent an executioner instead and summoned Sarkhan to the capital to answer for the crime of letting her live this long. He'd come to be exactly that executioner, but apparently he didn't mean to let that stand in the way of claiming he'd done me a kindness.
I didn't know how to answer anything so brazen. The only thing I could have managed would have been an inarticulate hiss. But he didn't force me to that point. He said only in a gentle voice that suggested I was being unreasonable. Think a little about what I've told you. I don't blame you for your anger, but don't let it make you spurn good advice, and gave me a courtly bow. He withdrew gracefully, even as Kasha rejoined me. The soldiers were getting back on their horses. Her face was sober, and she was rubbing her arms. The dragon had gone to mount his own horse. I glanced over at him, wondering what he'd said to her. "Are you all right?" I asked Kasha. "He told me not to fear I was still corrupted," she said. Her mouth moved a little, the ghost of a smile. "He said if I could fear it, I probably wasn't." Then, even more unexpectedly, she added, "He told me he was sorry I'd been afraid of him, of being chosen, I mean. He'd said he wouldn't take anyone again." I had shouted at him over that. I hadn't ever expected him to listen. I stared at her, but I didn't have any time to wonder. Janos had mounted, looked his men over, and he said abruptly, "Where is Michal?" We counted heads and horses and called loudly in every direction. There was no answer, and no trail of broken branches or stirred leaves to show which way he'd gone. He'd been seen only a few moments before, waiting to give his horse water. If he'd been snatched, it had been silently.
"Enough," the dragon said at last. "He's gone."
Janos looked at the prince in protest, but after a silent moment, Marek said finally,
"We go on. Ride two by two and keep in each other's sight."
Janos's face was hard and unhappy as he wrapped the scarf closely over his nose and mouth again, but he jerked his head at the first two soldiers, and after a moment, they started into motion down the path. We rode on into the wood. Beneath the boughs, it was hard to tell what time it was, how long we'd been riding. The wood was silent, as no forest ever was. No hum of insects. Not even the occasional twig snap under a rabbit's foot. Even our own horses made very little noise. Hooves coming down on soft moss and grass and saplings instead of bare dirt. The track was running out. The men in the front had to hack at the brush all the time to give us a way through at all. A faint sound of rushing water came to us through the trees. The track abruptly widened again. We halted. I stood up in my stirrups, and over the shoulders of the soldier in front of me, I could just see a break in the trees. We were on the bank of the spindle again. We came out of the forest nearly a foot above the river, on the soft sloping bank. Trees and brush overhung the water, willows trailing long weedy branches into the reeds that clustered thickly at the water's edge, between the pale tangle of exposed tree roots against the wet dirt. The spindle was wide enough that over the middle, sunlight broke through the interlaced canopy of the trees. It glittered on the river's surface without penetrating, and we could tell most of the day had gone. We sat for a long moment in silence. There was a wrongness to meeting the river like this, cutting across our path. We'd been riding east. We should have been alongside it. When Prince Marek raised his fist towards the water, the violet gleam shone bright, beckoning us across to the other side. But the water was moving swiftly, and we couldn't tell how deep it was. Janos tossed in a small twig from one of the trees. It was dragged away downstream at once, and vanished almost immediately under a little glossy swell.
"We'll look for a ford," Prince Marek said.
We turned and went on riding single file along the river, the soldiers hacking away at the vegetation to give the horses a foothold on the bank. There was never any sign of an animal track leading down to the edge,
and the spindle ran on, never narrowing. It was a different river here than in the valley, running fast and silent beneath the trees, as shadowed by the wood as we were. I knew that the river never came out on the other side in Rosia. It vanished somewhere in the deep part of the wood, swallowed up in some dark place. That seemed almost impossible to believe here, looking at the white dark stretch of it. Somewhere behind me, one of the men sighed deeply, a relieved noise, as though he were setting down a heavy weight. It was loud in the wood's silence. I looked around. His scarf had sagged down from his face. It was the friendly young soldier with the broken nose who'd led my horse to water. He reached out with the knife drawn, sharp and bright silver, and caught the head of the man riding in front of him and cut his throat in one deep red gash from side to side. The other soldier died without a sound. The blood sprayed out over the animal's neck and onto the leaves. It reared wildly, crying out, and as the man sagged down off its back, it floundered into the brush and disappeared. The young soldier with the knife was still smiling. He threw himself off his own horse into the water. We were frozen by the suddenness of it. Up ahead of me, Prince Marek gave a shout and flung himself off his own mount and down the slope, dirt furrowing away from his boots as he slid to the water's edge. He tried to reach out and catch the soldier's hand, but the man didn't reach back. He went past the prince on his back, floating like driftwood, the ends of his scarf and cloak trailing away in the water behind him. His legs were already being dragged down as his boots filled with water. Then his whole body was sinking. We had one last pale flash of his round face staring upwards in the sun. The water closed in over his head, over the broken nose. The cloak went down with the last green billowing. He was gone. Prince Marek had climbed back up to his feet. He stood down on the bank, watching, gripping the trunk of one narrow sapling for balance, until the soldier went under. Then he turned and clambered up the slope. Janos had slid down from his own mount, catching Marek's reins. He reached down an arm to help him up. Another one of the soldiers had caught the reins of the other, now riderless, horse. It was trembling, its nostrils flaring, but it stood still. Everything settled back into quiet again. The river ran on, the branches hung still, the sun shone on the water. We didn't even hear any noise from the horse that had run away. It was as though nothing had happened. The dragon pushed his horse down the line and looked down at Prince Marek. "The rest of them will go by nightfall," he said bluntly, "if not you as well." Marek looked up at him, his face for the first time open and uncertain, as though he'd just seen something beyond his understanding. I saw the falcon beside him, looking back along the line of the men with unblinking eyes, his piercing eyes trying to see something invisible. Marek looked at him, the falcon looked back and nodded very slightly, confirming. The prince hauled himself up into his saddle. He spoke to the soldiers ahead of him. "Cut us a clearing." They started to hack at the brush around us. The rest of them joined in, burning and salting it as they went, until we had cleared enough room to crowd in together. The horses were eager to push their heads in and butt up closely against one another. "All right," Marek said to the soldiers, their gazes fixed on him. "You all know why you're here. Every one of you is handpicked. You are men of the North, the best I have. You followed me into Rosian sorcery and made a wall beside me against their cavalry charges. There is not a one of you who doesn't wear the scars of battle. I asked every one of you before we left if you'd ride into this benighted place with me.
Every one of you said yes. Well, I won't swear to you now, I'll bring you out alive. But you have my oath that every man who does come out with me will have every honor I can bestow, and every one of you made a landed knight, and will ford the river here, now, however best we can, and we will ride on together, to death or worse perhaps, but like men, and not like frightened voles.
They must have known by then that Marek himself didn't know what would happen, that he hadn't been ready for the shadow of the wood. But I could see his words lift some of the shadow from all of their faces. A brightness came into them, a deep breath. None of them asked to turn back. Marek took his hunting horn from his saddle. It was a long thing, made all of brass, bright, polished, and circled on itself. He put it to his mouth and blew with all his voice, an enormous martial noise that shouldn't have made my heart leap, but did, brash and ringing. The horses stamped and flicked their ears back and forth, and the soldiers drew their swords and roared along with that note. Marek willed his horse and led us in a single headlong rush down the slope and into the cold, dark water, and all the other horses followed. The river hit my legs like a shock as we plunged into it, foaming away from my horse's broad chest. We kept going. The water climbed up over my knees, over my thighs. My horse had its head held up high, nostrils flaring as its legs beat at the riverbed, surging forward and trying to keep purchase on the bottom. Somewhere behind me, one of the horses stumbled and lost its footing. It was tumbled over at once and carried into another soldier's horse. The river swept them away and swallowed them whole. We didn't stop. There was no way to stop. I groped for a spell, but I couldn't think of anything. The water was roaring at me, and then they were gone. Prince Marek sounded another blast from his horn. He and his horse were lurching up on the other side of the river, and he was kicking it onward into the trees. One by one, we came up out of the river, dripping wet, and kept going without a pause, all of us crashing through the brush, following the purple blaze of Marek's light up ahead, following the sound of his calling horn. The trees were whipping by us. Their underbrush was lighter on this side of the river, the trunks larger and farther apart. We weren't riding in a single line anymore. I could see some of the other horses weaving through the trees beside me as we flew, as we fled, running away as much as running towards. I had given up all hope of the reins and just clung to my own horse with my fingers woven into the mane, bent over its neck, away from lashing branches. I could see Kasha near me and the bright flash of the Vulcan's white cloak ahead. The mare was panting beneath me, shuddering, and I knew she couldn't last. Even strong, trained war horses would founder ridden like this after swimming a cold river.
Nen El Shayon, I whispered to her ears. Nen El Shayon,
and let her have a little strength, a little warmth. She stretched out her fine head and tossed it gratefully, and I closed my eyes and tried to widen it to all of them, saying, Nen El Shayin, pushing out my hand towards Kasha's horse, as though throwing it a line. I felt that imagined line catch. I flung more of them out, and the horses drew closer together, running more easily again. The dragon threw a brief look back at me over his shoulder. We kept on, riding behind the blowing horn, and now I started to see something moving through the trees at last. Walkers, many walkers, and they were coming towards us rapidly, all their long stick legs moving in unison. One of them stretched out a long arm and caught one of the soldiers off his horse, but they were falling behind us, as if they hadn't expected our pell-mell speed. We burst together through a wall of pines into a vast clearing, the horses leaping to clear a stand of brush, and before us stood a monstrous heart tree. The trunk of it